Hello, my name is Philip Miriton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Miriton.
Each week on this show, we try to push the outer limits of knowledge a little bit farther. We try to explore with an open mind cutting-edge ideas, new paradigms, and original perspectives. Now today there is no doubt we are going to break new ground because we have on the show one of the most original thinkers in the world in the area of human consciousness and near-death experiences, Anthony Peake from the United Kingdom. Now Tony is the author of several books, including Is There Life After Death?, The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die?, The Labyrinth of Time, and The Out-of-Body Experience. But what, in my mind, makes Tony unique is that he seeks to base his ideas upon science and scientific theories. This makes his books not only interesting to read, for who doesn't like to read about strange stories of folks who can't predict the future, travel out of their bodies, near-death experiences, and lucid dreams, but the thoroughness of his research gives his work credibility. One steps away thinking, boy, that's strange, but it might be real. So today, Anthony Peake and I are going to talk about immortality, life after life or life after death. We're going to talk a little bit about those topics. And death, as we know, is a big topic. And for one, because most of us would prefer for it not to intrude upon our lives. And second, because everyone who has ever lived has apparently died, at least in some way. But I want to start with an excerpt from the Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. And this is just a little excerpt from a story in that book, which I think may set the tone for the discussion. And there's a story in there about how these five brothers were exiled to the forest by a competing king. They were thirsting. A voice comes out of the woods and starts asking the brothers questions. But one by one, the brothers are too thirsty. They drink the water and they die without having answered the question. But then the last brother, we'll call him Yudi, chooses to answer the question of the voice. And one of the questions is, of all the world's wonders, which is the most wonderful? And Yudi answers, that no man, though he sees others dying all around him, believes he himself will not die. So the brothers are brought back to life through a miracle, and it turns out that the voice in the forest was that of God. Now this story tells me something. Perhaps we are really immortal, or perhaps there is something inside of us that seeks immortality. With that little story, I'd like to introduce you all to Anthony Peake. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Philip, very much. What a wonderful story to actually start the interview with. Absolutely intriguing.
It really has always struck me, because I think you could read that story as being a negative, like maybe we're all fooling ourselves. Or maybe there's truth in the answer. Let's start with maybe that story as being a little basis here. What led you to your interest in this topic of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences?
Well, curiously enough, I'm not an experiencer of many things, and my interest has been a lifelong interest, but purely and simply from an experiential and a scientific viewpoint. In other words, ever since I was very young, I realized there was something not quite right about reality, in the sense that here I am, a sentient, thinking, self-reflective being, existing in a world that is in effect made up of inanimate matter. And indeed, I used to think when I was younger that if my body was taken apart into its chemical constituents, it would be inanimate matter. But somewhere along the line, something magical takes place whereby all this inanimate matter comes together and creates an internal consciousness and a self-reflective consciousness. Indeed, I'm reminded of Professor Ramachandran, who I think it was in 2005, who he's an English neurologist. and he did the annual Reith lectures for the BBC, which are broadcast on British television. And one of the things he said, even though he is in effect a materialist reductionist in these things, and he said, "What is it that brings? Why is it that bits of jelly and bits of electricity in my brain can create the feeling of being me?" And that has always intrigued me. But effectively, my whole journey started really with a burning desire to write a book, but I didn't know what I was going to be writing about. And what took place was that literally I was in the fortunate position of being able to take a year out of my normal career as a management consultant. And I didn't know what I wanted to write about, but I just had the need to write a book. And as I was sitting in front of the computer screen, I started to feel rather strange. You know, literally, I had the Word document open and it was blank. And as I did so, I started to feel rather strange. And I had tingling in my lips and the end of my fingers. And I realized that what was happening was I was about to have a migraine attack. Huh. Because I suffer from classic migraine. So I knew that I was getting the aura sensations. But what then happened was quite strange, because I suddenly then had this overwhelming sensation that I'd sat in front of that computer screen before, looking out over the houses around me in Horsham in West Sussex, where I lived at the time, and an overwhelming feeling that I had done that before. And not only that, but there was significance to the fact that I had done this before. And when I came out of the aura state, I realized that the book would probably be about the deja vu phenomenon. Because déjà vu is linked to the aura that people have before they have a migraine attack. It's also linked to people when they have something, when they experience something called temporal lobe epilepsy. And it was from there I spun out, and I contacted various experts around the world about the déjà vu phenomenon. And I was just intrigued. You know, is this a memory of a past I have had? Is it me pulling together information that I have seen before, and my brain is putting it together and trying to create a pattern of recognition? Because, as you know, we are programmed to see patterns in things, like we see patterns in clouds and right. things. And we see patterns in the things we see around us. And therefore, it's not surprising that sometimes we'll have a degree of recognition. But what I found was that the whole overall déjà vu phenomenon is mysterious in the extreme, in that there was, and even if you read the books now, you'll find that there's a very precise description of it, which is called the visual pathways hypothesis, which was put forward by a guy called Robert Efron in 1961. And Efron suggested that what is happening is, to put it simply, is that your non-dominant hemisphere of your brain has processed a visual signal about half a second before your dominant hemisphere does. But that signal crosses the corpus callosum, which is the thing that holds the two sides of the brain together, into your dominant hemisphere. So you get a kind of echo effect whereby you've already subliminally, your non-dominant hemisphere has processed something, but you haven't, on the normal level of consciousness, received it. But on a subliminal level, you have. And then you perceive it through your dominant hemisphere, and you get this feeling of recognition. So interestingly enough, there was some work has been done by a guy called Akira O'Connor at the University of Leeds over here in the UK. And Akira works with a guy called Chris Moulon, who's the professor of psychology there. And they have a research unit that deals with the déjà phenomenon. And they have found that people who have been born blind, i.e. congenitally blind, also have sound déjà vu sensations, technically déjà senti, where they hear something twice. And because the pathways in the brain are completely different from hearing than they are from sight, it effectively puts the visual pathways argument out of the water. So clearly what really is happening here is déjà vu does seem to be what it seems to, what we believe it to be. It's a memory of something that's happened in our past somewhere.
Yeah, now let's set the table a little bit, because there was a lot of information in what you just said, and for those listeners to sort of put this into context, to me the first step in analyzing this type of issue is to be clear about some basic concepts, and that would be materialistic reductionism. And that would mean that that all that really exists are is in my mind matter, and I would also say that the strict view of that would be dead matter, and that consciousness grew out of somehow as an epiphenomena arises from dead matter. That's one view. Then there is the idealistic view, which is based upon Hinduism and the Western idealist philosophies, and many people have heard of George Berkeley, Bishop George Berkeley, who believed that all was mind. And then there is sort of a middle ground, which some people call dualism, which I think is probably the leading description of it, where in some ways both mind and matter exist and are somehow parallel, and that's another rich topic. But it's important, what you said in the beginning, Tony, was when you were talking about what drove you to your research and your writing was and it, the way I understood what you said was, how can this richness, this incredible experience that we call consciousness, arise from jelly? And correct me if what I've said was inaccurate, but I'd like to have the listeners understand that this is really one of the deep mysteries of our lives right now. Mm-hmm. And it's still unresolved, and it's one reason why it's so interesting.
Philip, yeah, go on.
Yeah, and so because we have people who are strict materialists, such as Shermer, Michael Shermer, who is a professional skeptic. I think he wrote the recent book, Why People Believe the Things They Do, or something like that. He's basically skeptical of anything unusual, anything involving the paranormal, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, ESP, the whole thing, because he doesn't see any way that science can explain those things. But then we have the irrefutable evidence that these experiences do occur. And so one of the quests of science, in my mind, is to change the worldview of science to encompass these irrefutable, these undeniable human experiences. And so I guess from the deja vu perspective, question I have for you is, what camp would you put yourself into? Because I see that you've been called a dualist. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think you're able to put yourself in whatever camp you think you should be in, but where do you come down on this categorization, materialistic, dualistic, idealistic, or do you have your own sort of perspective on it?
Probably, if I had to define myself, particularly as, because one of the things I always consider that my writing is always, it's developmental. You know, I'm on a journey of searching, and my books very much reflect the things I am discovering, both about the universe, about myself, about research in various areas, neurology, quantum physics, and such like. So my position sort of changes, because I believe that, you know, you have to. You can't just paint yourself into a corner and decide that's where you're going to be forever and a day. And my position at the moment is very much moving to a profoundly non-dualist point of view, which is effectively that at a deeper level of reality, the concept of mind and matter really are just aspects of the same thing.
Right.
You know, so it's going back to the kind of the Buddhist, the Vedanta kind of concepts and everything else, that, you know, at a deeper level of reality, everything is a unity. So therefore, we have an illusion of the fact that there's separation, because that's how the mind works. The mind actually places space around things and such like. Now, I was also intrigued on your point there. Effectively, yes, in many ways, some of my ideas could be considered to be profoundly solipsistic, in the sense of, you know, very Berkeleyan, in the sense, you know, of the idea that the only thing I can know with any certainty is the fact that, as Descartes would say, you know, I'm thinking and I'm consciously aware of things, which to me amazes me that people like Michael Shermer, and to a greater extent people like Daniel Dennett in his book Consciousness Explained,
right,
paint themselves into this phenomenal, difficult, reductionist corner, whereby, and it's the same with the Churchlands as well, where they literally deny that there is any internal dialogue going on, that, you know, that somehow I'm fooling myself into believing that I am actually a self-reflective being. Now, to me, the word empiricism and empirical is from experience. So I know empirically, immediately, that Daniel Dennett is wrong, right, and the church funds are wrong, because I do have an inner world. And indeed, when we discuss people like Michael Shermer, it always amazes me that Michael Shermer was a fundamentalist Christian when he was at university.
Yeah.
So therefore, Michael Shermer is in the position that he tends to go to extremes in his beliefs, which leads me to believe that he fervently believes something until he doesn't believe it and then fervently believes the complete opposite, which to me, considering when I was at university, I was not a fundamentalist Christian, whereas Michael Shermer was, which leads me to believe that I've always been somewhat of an open thinker, whereas Michael Shermer just wants things to cling to and believe to them. I would imagine that Michael Shermer would just need one noetic experience to take place in his life to completely radically change his viewpoint, as has happened with many reductionist materialists.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, I'm very much non-dual at the moment, and very interested in some of these areas. In fact, the person that was really intriguing me at the moment is, have you come across the work of Bernard Haish?
Right. Yeah, you're right. We had him on the show earlier this year. I'm a big fan. I mean, I thought his books, The God Theory and the other one, Purpose-Driven Universe, yes,
are magnificent, aren't they? Yeah. They're magnificent works, because what they're doing is they're taking non-dualism to the next level. You know, he's effectively saying that effectively we are all one entity. And although I spoke to Bernard about this recently, and I don't think he was necessarily aware that even people like the American comedian Bill Hicks had very much had similar ideas. And I know that a considerable group of people who are interested in entheogens, substances that seem to open up your mind to God, one of the very first things they come across when they get involved in these substances is this realization of the unity of everything. So it's very, very intriguing. And I'm very excited as to where my world is going, because my writing is leading me to some very exciting places and places I find incredibly intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, and I think what's really exciting about this field, and I mean this in the real sense, is that the walls between science and, I guess I could use the word spirituality, I'd rather use the word philosophy, because I have a philosophy background, but I could use the word spirituality. The walls are breaking down, because you have people like Bernard Haish, and to a lesser extent, you have people like Bruce Rosenblum, one of the authors of Quantum Enigma. And then there's Fred Allen Wolf, who's always been a open-minded thinker. There's all sorts of people that are bridging the gap between science and spirituality, coming from the scientific perspective. Okay, now yours truly, I come from the philosophical perspective, going to the science, and I think you are sort of open-minded. I think, and I'm not sure where you would start and whether it makes any difference. But the point is that what's exciting is that the walls are coming down, and I would say 50%, 60% of the people on this show, all of whom are educated, authors of best-selling books, they all think that a new scientific paradigm is coming. And it's for the reason that the current materialistic model, it has sort of had its day. It's becoming archaic, because it doesn't explain everything. And when you get into it, it's riddled with assumptions that cannot really be established, and so this is what makes this exciting. And I will say that to me you said the magic word, which is the open-minded part of this. If you close your mind to possibilities, you're never going to see what's out there. So let's talk about life after death, and let's define our terms a little bit here, because I think this is important. And I'm not sure. I think there's three important terms we sort of have to define. One of them is what are we? Because before we figure out what is going to live or what's dying, we have to define what we are. So let me ask you that unfair question. What is it that you think is essential to what we are?
What an intriguing question. I suppose effectively what we are a sentient presence, as I said before, a kind of a sentient existence in a non-sentient universe. And this presence seems to be almost dropped in from elsewhere into this alien world of matter. And we exist within this world of matter for a finite period of time. So for a large period of time, we do not exist. Then we exist as a self-referential being for an incredibly short period of time. And then if you're a materialist reductionist, we then disappear back into the ether rather like virtual particles jump in and out of the areas around a black hole. And we just seem to disappear back in again. So to me, it is a question of I am something that knows I am something, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think from the philosophical tradition and the Buddhist tradition, what you said is not a lot different from what the philosophers and the Buddhists would say. And I think it's important all these instances to try to put what we say in context, because in many ways, what we do, and I'm using the royal we, and I'm going to say what I do, and I think what you do often, is that we really rephrase the old questions in modern language. We're really, whether we're applying new metaphors or whether we're just giving it new terminology. And let me give you an example. Descartes, in his Meditations, he answered the question by saying that his essence is a mind. And that was the basis of his famous "I think, therefore I am," because when he doubted everything, he doubted the world, he doubted his body, he doubted, but he could not doubt the fact that he could think. And when he went inside, he found that he was a mind. And then the Buddhists are similar, because the Buddhists believe that all that really exists is this stream of becoming, that the material world is an illusion or is a secondary reality. Then you have somebody like David Hume, another philosopher who came after Descartes, who basically looked inside and said all there is a stream of experiences. We call the self this thing, this collection of perceptions. And so it's not, I mean, when you said that, you know, your presence, it's sort of a similar thing to me. To me, my answer would be we define ourselves by our perceptions, and we have to have a self in order to exist out in the world, because otherwise we don't have a part to play. And I don't know, and to me, the easiest way to answer the question, which is sort of unfair, to say, are we really just physical bodies, or is there something more impermanent, or more eternal inside of us? I take it from your research that you think there is something that's longer lasting, that we're not just our bodies.
Very much so. I mean, rather like yourself, you know, I'm a sociologist by training, but effectively I've always been deeply interested in the aspects of the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of consciousness, you know, and, you know, I've read a fair amount around the subject. And, you know, the one ongoing mystery is exactly this idea of something that is self-referential, whether it is that I exist purely and simply as a reaction to external stimuli. In other words, if, as friends of mine who are trained in deep meditative techniques and train people in these, they always say that if you start to look inside yourself and start to look inward to define exactly what you are by looking into yourself to understand what you are, you suddenly find there's nothing there. That effectively we are always reacting to things. And whenever we try to capture that essence that is us, we lose it in some way, which effectively could mean that, you know, we are more of a collective life form that's experiencing itself subjectively. Now, to me, the clearly, you know, as you know, David Chalmers uses this in his right. famous argument of the hard problem of consciousness, and the idea that modern science has absolutely not the first clue as to how the concept of my existence and being me comes about. So therefore one has to assume that the brain itself does not create me. What creates me is the brain must be some form of receiver by which whatever I am is able to manifest in the three-dimensional universe that we exist within. You know, that I'm attuned to a certain level of electrum, that I live within a certain level of vibrations. My world is defined by certain vibrationary levels of electromagnetic energy. This is what makes me what I am. But effectively, this is just a singular manifestation. And in fact, one of the things that I write in my books, which you'll probably recall, is that Daniel Dennett has a concept which he calls the Cartesian theatre, which is his way of sniffingly dismissing the whole idea of an inner life by saying that there is no such thing as the Cartesian theatre in the head, whereby there's a little homunculus that has a TV screen and a set of speakers, and that's how it perceives the world, because that becomes an infinite regress.
Right.
I take it the other way around, and I turn around, I have a term called the Bohmian IMAX, and I say it's far more complex than that. And I take it that instead of a Cartesian theatre, we are existing in an internally generated reality that's projected outwards by the mind into external reality. And this is created by drawing up information from something called the zero-point field. And we create this world around us. So rather like Teilhard de Chardin said, you know, I'm not a physical being having a spiritual life. I'm a spiritual being having a physical life. And that to me just makes so much sense. But most people are in denial about this because they don't like the concept of, as Gilbert Ryle called it, the ghost in the machine. They just don't like it. It's an anathema. Whereas we know experientially that that is the only real truth we have.
Yeah, I want to emphasize something that is really sort of positive and promising about where this conversation is heading, and that is, to the extent that we are spiritual creatures and not robots, we have a greater control over who we are and what we become. And I'm not really sort of advocating at this point sort of the New Age theory or belief that we could create our own reality. There is some truth to that, I think. But we're saying that the base of who we are, to the extent we are spirits, then the only thing limiting us would be our beliefs, thinking that we are limited, and so this is my big complaint about modern materialistic science and why I think that it needs to be changed, to put it nicely. Is because I believe that the modern science paradigm, the materialistic paradigm, limits the creatures that we can be by telling us that we are only matter, that we live short lives and slide away into the graves, that we are random descendants from some common ancestor. And so to me, this is powerful. Because to the extent it becomes scientifically based, that it will start to, I think, permeate our mindset. Again, this to me is what makes this so exciting. Let's go on for a second here, that you've spent a lot of time with this concept of life after death and near-death experiences. And let's, in your mind, right now, what do you think death is? What we call death? Do you think that's the end of it all, or is there something else that we're missing in the picture?
I think the thing we are missing in the picture is something I discuss in my book, The Labyrinth of Time, and I think the thing that confuses the issue is that we exist in time. So my life is a linear existence from one point in time to another point in time. However, if when I die, time in effect ceases to be, in other words, I'm no longer in some kind of temporal existence, and my subjective perception of that temporal existence changes, I can effectively become immortal. in the sense that I die in time. But effectively, we know from experimentation, we know from subjective experience, that time itself can become elastic under certain circumstances, can actually slow down under certain circumstances, can speed up under times of danger. And we know that certain neurotransmitters can bring about this sensation of time speeding up and slowing down. So if one escapes from the trap of time, then suddenly immortality suddenly then becomes more understandable, in the sense that I could die in your perception viewpoint, within your, as Charles Peirce called it, your phaneron, your worldview. I could die, but effectively within myself, I continue to exist. And one of the things that has fascinated me here is that I don't know if you've come across the thought experiments suggested by Professor Max Tegmark, and it's called the quantum suicide experiment. And we haven't got time to go into detail about this, but I suggest that your listeners check this out. But basically, Tegmark takes the implications of the Schrödinger's cat thought experiment and applies it to consciousness. And he concludes that within our own universe, within our own collapsed wave function, for want of a better term, we can never die, because our universe needs us as an observer to continue. Now, the question then arises is that if our universe needs us to continue to exist in order for it to exist, how can that happen in time? And the question and the answer is no, it can't. So effectively, at the point of death, something must happen to time. Now, again, there is an English philosopher mathematician by the name of Julian Barber, who is an Oxford mathematician, very, very bright gentleman. And he has written a book called The End of Time. And in this, he describes in mathematical terms and in physical terms how a place can exist that time doesn't exist. He actually calls it Platonia, because he argues this is the location of the idealistic ideas of the forms, where everything, we are a reflection of a greater reality that's outside of ourselves, that's timeless. So this is where my hypothesis comes forward, because I suggest that at the point of death, effectively something very peculiar happens that the brain facilitates. And it's that time itself changes. The amount of times then people, when they have near-death experiences or they're in car accidents and such like, claim that time just seems to slow down for them. And it's a very, very common occurrence. Raymond Moody came across, he's one of the leading experts on the near-death experience. And the Moody traits are a series of things that people experience when they have a near-death experience. And one of these Moody traits is, in fact, the slowing down of time. So clearly, it's time that's the issue for me. So we are immortal within our own phaneron and with our own time, or what I call our own Bohmian IMAX.
So I think it would be interesting if you can give, you know, one of the near-death, I mean, you've done a lot of research on near-death experiences, and there's a lot of interesting anecdotes in your book, Is There Life After Death? Which one strikes you as being the most credible?
Again, a very interesting question, because I know of so many cases, and I tend to put them together, yeah, in groupings, in terms of typologies and such like. But I was told of a case where somebody had. No, I know. One of my favourite ones, yeah, is cited by a person who contacted me. We're both members of an organisation called the Scientific and Medical Network, which is a group of scientists and medical people and interested philosophers and other individuals who get together and discuss issues. And the guy in question is a guy called Will Merthyr. And Will was cycling along the towpath near Dawlish Warren in the south of England, along the English Channel coast. And it was an evening in early April, and he was cycling along to a raised towpath as a freak wave came over and knocked him off his bike. And as he was getting to stand up again. Another wave hit him, and it threw him into the sea. The wall is about 40 foot high, so it throws him 40 foot into the sea, and the tide starts to take him out. And he very quickly realizes that nobody knows he's fallen off the bike, nobody has seen it happen, and he's already been drawn out to sea. He immediately starts to hypothermia starts to kick in, and he realizes he's going to die. And the things that happen to him as his body shuts down were absolutely phenomenal. In the sense that he, and this is where it becomes intriguing, as he's lying there dying, and as he turned around to me and he said, and as he says in his book, Dying for a Change, hypothermia, when people think it's really a nice way to die, it's not. It's extremely painful because you feel all of your organs cutting out.
Yeah.
Now, he was an extremely strong swimmer, so he could fall into life, and he's a sportsman as well. But he, as he was floating in the water, feeling his life ebb away, he looked up and a seagull flew over, and he realized he was the seagull. And he realized he was the cliffs and he was the water around him. He had what the mystics would call the oceanic feeling, the oceanic sensation of your body expanding out to encompass the world around you. And then suddenly he has this floating above his body. And he hears a voice which starts to talk to him and starts to guide him. And then suddenly he is catapulted out of his body and he finds himself running across a street as a child. And as he looks up in the street, he realizes he's back in his own body as he was when he was 7 years of age. And as he looks up, he sees a car approaching him and the car hits him and knocks him to the floor. His consciousness then goes from the car, from the lying in the body of the child, to looking at being in a woman's body, looking down at a ladder in her stocking and fiddling with it. And then she looks up to see a child running across the road and she hits it. He then felt all the horror and fear of this woman getting out the car and looking at him, because this was an event that happened in his own life. And he feels the fear of the woman and the horror of what she's done. The next minute, he's out of his body again, and he's a disincarnate piece of consciousness looking down at the hallway of his house. And he sees he hears a knock on the door, and he sees his wife and his children go to the door and open the door, and there's a police officer there. And he hears the police officer announce that your husband's body's been found, washed up on the beach nearby. We're terribly sorry. And he hears the reaction, the anguish of his family. And then he's back in the water again, slowly dying. And meanwhile, this voice is talking to him, and this voice is guiding him, and the voice is saying to him, you really are living the wrong kind of life. You really have to change your life. You must change your life. Now, to cut a long story short, because we haven't got time, he is rescued in the most amazing set of circumstances. In fact, the set of circumstances appeared on a British TV program called 999, because it was such an amazing set of circumstances. But effectively, that near-death experience to me typified a lot of the events that I believe that really takes place during a near-death experience. He had the encounter with the being of light, the voice that guides him. He had a past life review. He had a future life review of a potential life that could have taken place. Since then, he's now given up all the things he used to do, and he's now a philanthropist, and he spends his time writing and traveling the world, lecturing and talking. And this is again, people have when they have near-death experiences, they have a change of worldview. But for me, what intrigues me about that whole case is, where did those memories come from?
Yeah.
Where were they generated? How was he able to evoke these images and get into the mind of somebody else in the circumstances?
Yeah.
So to me, that was most powerful, and it's because I know the guy.
Yeah, that is something else. And you know, you said it earlier in the show, where you mentioned that one thing that might convert some of the hardcore materialists is that if they do have an experience like that, and it strikes me that they're just number one, there's too many people that have had experiences of that nature, and I'm not saying of that, amazing nature, but there's too many people that have had sort of strange occurrences, whether it's an out-of-body experience, whether it's an amazing synchronicity, whether it's clairvoyance or whatever, to follow the materialistic paradigm and put differently. We know in our hearts that the materialistic paradigm cannot be true. And if a story like that is true, and I don't think there's any doubt it is true, then it really tells us that there's something more inside than random molecules dancing around our brains. And because, as you point out, how is it possible for his mind/brain to essentially create a movie, a movie, you know, of not only his past life, but different perspectives on his life. I mean, that's sort of what it sounds like. It's not like somebody made a documentary for him as he was approaching death. And so Tony, I want to get clear on this. Are stories like that, and there's many interesting stories like that, by the way, in Anthony Peake's book, Is There Life After Death, and I'm sure in your other books. But what bridge do you make, if any, between a story like that and other near-death experiences and this immortal soul or this life after death? What is the bridge that you see there?
Okay, the first point I'd make is, and it's always a very reasonable one, and people will always turn around and say the plural of anecdote is not evidence.
Right.
And to a certain extent, that is very, very true. However, one could argue that if that is the case, then every single experiment that has ever been done is technically anecdotal,
right?
Because it is supposedly repeatable, but at some stage that repeatability may not work. So one can't necessarily use that argument. And I still go back to the point that we are all experiential creatures. We all guide the world by empirical experiences, and we just know from our own experiences that these things are real. Now, the question is not to me whether Bill's experience was real, because it was. It's what it means and what it signifies about human consciousness and what it signifies about our own potential immortality. Now, what I would argue is that evidence from near-death experiences suggest that something very, very strange happens to human consciousness at the point of death. For example, I know of many cases, and in my book, The Out-of-Body Experience, I discuss some of the major cases of what one would call veridical out-of-body experiences during an NDE, where individuals supposedly can actually see things within the operating theatre. For instance, the Pam Reynolds case, where she described the device that was cutting in to her head as she was doing when she was involved in a particular operation.
So, Tony, you were talking about how these near-death experiences lead you to conclude that there is something that else that happens to us after death. Why don't you continue your explanation of this?
Okay. Well, I suppose near-death experiences, because they are in the first case they are phenomenally common. They have been recorded since ancient Greek times, when a gentleman called Er had clearly an out-of-the-body experience and had a rising up during a battle sequence. So clearly this is a universal. It happens in most cultures across the world. And the question is it a neurological situation? Is it a neurological construct? But even if it is a neurological construct, it still means it's real. The question is, does it give us evidence that we survive after death? And I would argue that the most important term to realize in this is near-death experience. It is a near-death experience. It's not an after-death experience. As far as I'm aware, nobody's actually ever physically died. And I mean, in really serious terms, physically died, had a near-death experience and come back and reporting what happened to them.
Right.
And this is why I believe that, I mean, people will argue that people like Pam Reynolds, for instance, is a classic case in question, where Pam Reynolds was was involved in an operation called Standby, whereby she had a virtually inoperable tumor at the base and in her brainstem. And in order to operate, they had to literally disengage her heart from her pumping blood around her body. They had to freeze. They had to bring down her bodily temperature around about 60 degrees. And effectively, they brought her. They virtually flatlined her. And the story goes, while she was flatlined, she managed to have an out-of-the-body experience and a near-death experience. There is certain evidence to say that possibly wasn't the case, and the actual near-death experience elements where she was meeting dead relatives could have taken place in a hypnopompic experience as she was coming out of the anesthetic. But that's beside the point. The point is that people do have these experiences, and they are very, very real. The question is, are they brain generated? And if they are brain generated, what does that tell us about what happens to us at the point of death? Now, in my book that you've read, I put forward a hypothesis I call Cheating the Ferryman. And in the Cheating the Ferryman hypothesis, I bring together a lot of the things I've talked about today, in the sense that I think what happens as we approach death is that a cocktail of neurotransmitters in the brain, I would particularly say as a culprit is a neurotransmitter called glutamate, is known to flood the brain. And it does so under times of stress. And in fact, it's glutamate that brings about the slowing down of experience when we have accidents and such like. Now, if that slows our consciousness down, another factor that people talk about in near-death experience is something called the panoramic life review, the my life flashed before my eyes hypothesis. And it's, again, extremely common. Now, imagine in a real death experience, when somebody actually is about to die and not come back, that the life flashing before your eyes is not a life flashing by at all, but is a literal minute-by-minute recreation of your life from your past life memories, created in your mind in exactly the same way as the brain generates the reality you're perceiving now. Because after all, if you read books on consciousness studies and perception studies, most of us fall for something called the naive realism idea, which is that we believe that everything we are perceiving and seeing is actually an accurate facsimile of a reality that is out there, when the reality is it isn't. The brain models the information from electrical impulses that are actually spread across the brain, and it inwardly generates an illusion of reality that we take to be reality. So in a dying person, all that happens is the brain effectively recreates exactly the same illusion using internal information. And in doing so, it creates a literal facsimile of your life from the first moment of your birth to, the last moments of your life. And you live it again in a literal minute-by-minute reliving of that life. And at the end of that, and this all takes place in the final split seconds of life. While you're living that life, there will be elements of you that will remember you've lived it before. That's a deja vu sensation.
Right.
Exactly what it says on the tin. It's the fact that you have this, as Vernon Nepe, who's a Seattle-based psychiatrist, was the guy that first came up with the definition of the deja vu sensation. And I can't remember the exact definition, but it's something along the lines of, it's a memory of a past incident sometime in your past that you can't define. Now, effectively, this is how deja vu sensations are. Now, if I'm living my life again, there will be times when I'll go, you know, I've done this before. There will be a breakthrough of memory. And people have this a lot. Now, I then suggest that you live your life again, and at the end of that second life, in an even smaller bit of time, the same thing happens again and again and again. It's like Groundhog Day, the movie. And what you do is you live a life over and over and over again, probably hundreds, thousands of times. But the difference is, and this is an important explanation, is that this information that is creating inwardly, and in my next book, by the way, I'll be doing the modeling of how this works, and I'm using a concept called virtual photons and biophotons, because this light is drawn up from the zero point field of energy, and this light, this internal light, is processed internally possibly by the pineal gland, to create a reality. Now, the information that's been drawn up from the zero point field is the old Hindu concept of the Akashic field, the Akashic record. And in there is programmed everything that ever has happened and everything that ever could happen, because it's timeless. So it's like a super duper video game that contains the you know, if you're playing a computer game, first person computer game, if your sprite on the screen, you decide to take down a different pathway and the sprite gets killed, you go back to the start of the game and you play the game again, but this time you have prior knowledge of the thing that killed your whoever you are on the screen. So you can avoid that incident, and effectively you recreate, or the computer recreates, the program based upon the movement you've just made. Because within the disk, everything is already encoded. So any decision you make on the screen effectively can be carried through. Okay. Now, if life is like this, this is what it means. So you live the life again in this Bohmian IMAX, as I call it. You're like you're in your own computer game. But in it, you interface with other people. Now, if we take Bernard Hache's God theory, and we take the theories of people like James Orrick and other individuals, and you take the idea that we are effectively a single consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, all those possible lives can be lived and fulfilled. So you have the opportunity in this Bohmian IMAX to fulfill all the opportunities in your life that you had before. Now, this is where it starts to become almost teleological in its process, because what I think is happening here, it's like the Buddhist bardo state. In the point before you die, you know, the Buddhists have this idea of the bardo. What I think is happening, the bardo is a literal, is correct, but it's like a Bohmian IMAX. It's my Bohmian IMAX. You're living your life, multiple lives over and over again. And every time you live your life, you will find that you start to live the perfect life. Again, it's like Connors in the film Groundhog Day. He lives the same life day over and over again. And in the end, he lives the perfect day, where he does good for doing good's sake. You know, he makes sure that he's underneath the tree to catch the little boy who falls out the tree. He tries to save the old man who's dying. It's as if, you know, over multiple lives, we then get it right. So it's almost a kind of a reversal of the Buddhist and Hindu idea of reincarnation, but it's more specific to you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you about the reincarnation connection, but we have to ask the most common question right now would be, so therefore the standard view of death is that we are our bodies, and that when the body dies and gets buried, we are therefore dead. What we are, this sort of joins together with how we started the show, what we are is now dead. It's gone. It's forever washed away from what we call life. And you're saying that that is not true? Or at least there's a chance it's not true. That we are...
I was going to say, of course, this is supposition. It's right. Supposition. Based upon fairly good information regarding the neurological constructs of the brain, and also reports by individuals who've had these kind of experiences.
Yeah.
So there's a certain degree of solidity to this. But yeah, to me, as I said before, the issue is time. Your body, after you die, rots because you're no longer in it. But you're no longer in it because you've moved out of that kind of... the dimension of space-time. Yeah. You're now living in another dimension of space-time. And in that dimension of space-time, you can live your life over and over again, and effectively manifest in a body. But when you think about it, our bodies themselves, we assume our body is solid. But of course it isn't. It's 99.99% empty space. And what is the space are actually ripples in space-time.
Right.
You know, the actual subatomic particles that make up our bodies aren't physically present. They're not there as kind of physical realities.
Right.
They're actually sort of ephemeral things that flit in and out of the cosmic matrix.
Right.
So therefore, even the idea of my body rotting is me misunderstanding the basic principles of physics.
Right.
There's nothing there to rot.
Right. And And I want to say that when I asked the question, which I attributed to the common inquiry regarding that we see people die all the time and we associate death with the body, that question itself assumes a materialistic, reductionistic basis. Because one of the major flaws that we make in this field, and by this field I mean the new science, new spirituality, new consciousness, whatever we're calling it, is that we still make the error of the naive realist, to my mind, where we talk about, okay, well, maybe the world's an illusion, maybe the world's a projection, but we don't include our own bodies in that analysis. But our bodies have to be part of the same reality because it's made of the same quote unquote quantum waves or quantum entities, whatever they are. And so therefore, if we're attributing this spiritual essence to the world itself, clearly we have to attribute that essence to our bodies. And so the way I'm sort of looking at what you're saying is that if we are spirits, or at least the nature of spirits, then our bodily deaths may not be the end of it all.
Correct.
And so I want to emphasize something here that I think you're saying that's very important, which is that you, and I would say the same thing for me, but you're probing, you're searching. As you just said, this is a supposition. We don't have empirical evidence of somebody coming back from the dead and reporting what it's really like, right? We have the closest we can get is the near-death experiences, right? And those are amazing experiences. People who report them, it's always just incredible to me because it does suggest that there is some kind of dance, some kind of richness going on inside that we don't fully understand. And until we understand that, it maybe is premature to say it all ends when the body wrinkles and fades away. I think that is really exciting. Now I want to touch upon something that we didn't get a chance to do because I think it's also important for the listeners to understand that many of your ideas and thoughts, it's not as if you just made them all up. They're well supported, and in fact, there is this area of Gnosticism from from early Christianity that I think you cite to, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about, but maybe you could just briefly mention what you've learned from early Christianity that supports some of your ideas.
Yeah, it very much intrigued me. And going back to your comment, I think it's a very fair one that, you know, I liken myself to Friedrich Schliemann when he discovered Troy, in the sense that I didn't know where I was going to go with all of this stuff. I had no idea. So the model has been built up literally by me excavating the information and pulling it together. So I had no planned intention on this. So it's quite important to realize that. But in terms of Gnosticism, I was absolutely fascinated by, I mean, I knew a little bit about Gnostic belief systems, but I didn't know the richness of them and the idea of the symbolism of the apocryphal gospels and the Nag Hammadi texts and the Dead Sea Scrolls, etc., seemed to have a rich interpretation of Christianity that is, it is somewhat different to the interpretation of Christianity that actually came through when the Council of Constance or wherever decided that this was the route Christianity was going to take, because it takes a very different viewpoint. And what it does is it tries to explain I can't think of the term now, that philosophers and theologians use for the explanation of why evil exists. Is it theos?
I don't know. The problem of evil,
yeah,
you mean?
There's a specific term, isn't there? Yeah. But the idea of why evil exists. And the Gnostics believe that this is because the world we live in, the creation we live within, has been created by somebody called Yaldabaoth, the demiurge, the false creator. And the demiurge has created this world, and we are trapped within it. But within us is a spark of something called a pleroma, which is the real universe behind the visual universe that we live within, the universe of the phenomenal experience. And there is another universe behind, and it is this universe that we move into when we die. But the universe we're trapped in at the moment, because we are creatures of matter, as you know, the thing that is considered to be an evil problem with the Gnostics is they believe that matter itself is inherently evil because it's created by the demiurge. But the spiritual side of us is completely different. But they have this incredible understanding of how the universe works, which is phenomenally intriguing. And it's not just Gnostic Christianity, because you take these ideas and you find them in the Kabbalah. You also find them in the Sufis. So clearly there is this Gnostic thread that runs through a lot of the Judeo-Christian religions, which can then be referred back to Maya, which is the Hindu concept of reality being an illusion and everything is an emanation of Brahman. So again, we have this idea that we are being fooled into thinking that the universe we exist within is all there is. And it's a category error that we make, but we can't make any other commit to other conclusion because this is what our senses tell us. But sometimes we get snapshots during noetic experiences, during near-death experiences, out-of-the-body experiences, call them what you will, we get glimpses of the pleroma, we get the glimpses of the reality behind the reality. And indeed, if you take this into quantum physics, all it is different levels of vibration. You know, the reason that I know my body is solid, because everything in my body is vibrating in the same way. The walls vibrate in the same way as my body does, so my hands can't go through the walls. But that doesn't mean that if the vibrationary levels were different, because if 99.99% of me is empty space and 99.99% of the wall is empty space, the reason that we don't go through it is because of the vibration levels. Now, so this takes a whole different picture of what reality is. And I think this is where quantum physics is now taking us. Quantum physics now is so damn near to philosophy as to be frightening.
Right.
You know, it's right. Why people like Erwin Schrödinger and Paul Eddington, he's an English comedian, Eddington and even Einstein became very, very philosophical because they could, towards the end of their lives, because they could see the philosophical implications of what they were discovering. The problem is that 90% of scientists are still based in the paradigm of 110 years ago. As you mentioned, Bruce Rosenblum and Fred Kuttner, when they wrote their book about consciousness, they were castigated beyond anything because they'd let the proverbial cat out of the bag. You know, right. That, you know, it's the hoi polloi aren't supposed to know about these things because somehow there's an arrogance to say that we won't understand it.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize for the readers what Tony is talking about with regard to the quantum enigma and Bruce Rosenblum and Fred Kuttner. Bruce Rosenblum was a guest earlier this year, and as I said, he's the author, co-author of The Quantum Enigma, and in that book, they talk about something called skeletons in the closet, and the skeleton in the closet is the fact that consciousness is a necessary part of interpreting quantum physics, and that's the way I read that, and that's what is so controversial about that book, because science is supposed to be talking about a world independent of mind, or a world that does not have a mind in it. And here you have these two professors, or former professors, saying that consciousness is a necessary part of quantum physics. When I talked to Bruce Rosenblum on this point, he came right on and said, well, everybody knows that, but nobody talks about it. And so I like to thank you, Tony, for your time. We left a lot of topics untouched, and I was afraid this was going to happen because I would love to spend some time talking about time and about quantum physics. But in the big picture, I think what we're saying here is that there's a richness to the world, to intellectual history, to the ideas, the spiritual foundations, the religious foundations, science, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. There's a richness to these experiences. They are real, And we need to have a paradigm that encompasses all of them and that puts them all into the same theory. Right now, we don't have such a worldview, but I think that most of us in this field would agree that the time is ripe for a new scientific paradigm. And perhaps this paradigm will tell us more about what occurs after life, or after death, and we will go back and maybe see that there was truth in the Bhagavad Gita, where the one brother answered that question, that there is something inside of us that yearns to be immortal, and maybe that he was right. Maybe we are really immortal creatures who have fooled ourselves into thinking that our lives will soon end. Now, Tony, you have a number of websites. Why don't you tell the listeners how to learn more about you and your books?
Okay, yeah, I have a master website, which is called anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H and a Y, and it's Peake, P-E-A-K-E, so that's anthonypeake.com. I'm also extremely active on Facebook. You'll find me as Anthony Peake on Facebook. And there are also one or two other smaller communities that are actually spinning off from my ideas. Now, my philosophy is very much inclusive. I do not believe that this whole cheating the Ferryman thing body, we're all experiential creatures existing in this universe, trying to make sense of things. So therefore, as far as I'm concerned, I'm open to ideas, I'm open to discussion, debate, and everything else, once the debate is what I would consider intellectually vigorous. And Philip, I would like to thank you very genuinely for a fascinating hour, because I think we must do this again, because I really find the way you think of things extremely stimulating, and you seem to think very much like I do, which is brilliant. You know, that kind of scene happening.
Yes. Well, definitely. As I said, I'm intrigued by your book, The Labyrinth of Time, because that is such a rich and elusive issue that I think that would be a lot of fun to address. So this is Philip Merton. I'd like to thank you, Tony, for your time, and I hope that the listeners have found this stimulating. I would highly recommend checking out Anthony's website and pick up one of his books for a real mind-opening experience. As I said, this is Philip Merton, and this is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Merton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.